Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. A candidate in the race for the 7th Congressional District drops out as national groups pour money into congressional campaign ads. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court hears a voter data case. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for April 24th.
I'm Ani Van Wagtendonk.
I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. We have a very Congress-heavy kind of news week this week, including one of the first kind of big dropouts of the race. Waskren in the 7th District has dropped out of the race. He is the kind of successful lawyer who had a very self-funded campaign. Recent campaign finance reports showed that he gave himself millions of dollars. Donors gave him about $4,000, a little bit less, and he dropped out saying that it's essentially to avoid a bloody primary, that he wants to make sure that, you know, Democrats sort of don't get any type of advantage up in this district. But what do you make of him departing?
Guys who can write checks in the seven figures aren't dumb, for the most part. People in general have that kind of money aren't stupid. They are good with their finances. And my impression is that Paul Waskren looked at his finances and went, okay, I can afford this much, but is this a good bet on myself to beat Michael Alfonso in this primary? Remember, Alfonso, still a lot of Sean Duffy, the beneficiary of many Duffy connections financially so far, endorsed by Donald Trump. What's my path, Paul asked himself, with this whole dynamic? The answer's not great. I mean, there was a path. But if you look at his finance report and drill down, yeah, he'd put like $3.2 million in, but it kind of inflated a little bit. There's this little interesting bookkeeping thing where he gave himself $1.7 million in the first quarter, but paid back $1.2 million. So either way, if he's going to spend $2, $3 million, there's a path. But you got to spend it, and you have to have the right combination of dynamics to win. If you have, so right now there's Paul's out, so I have Kevin Hermaning, who's a financial advisor, former Marathon County GOP chair. When he was a 20-year-old in 1979, he was a Marine that was taken hostage at the American Embassy in Iran. Jesse Eben, who was a director at Ashley Furniture, ran for the 3rd Congressional District in 2020 for nomination, Republican nomination, didn't get it. And then Nina Baum, who is this kind of newcomer, make herself out to be a moderate. That's a very big split of the anti-Alfonso vote. And there's an anti-Alfonso vote because he's kind of cashing in on his Duffy connections. But the more options you have for that anti-Alfonso vote, the less chance you have of consolidating it and beating Michael Alfonso. So for Waskren, I went, I got better to do with my money.
Yeah, and as you talk about Alfonso, right, there is this kind of discussion of him almost as though it's a coronation process. Mm-hmm. And we saw that in the candidate forum that took place in the 7th this week where, you know, Alfonso got the Trump endorsement and two of the remaining candidates are big Trump supporters, but they all kind of took turns saying, we don't want, you know, a red carpet just rolled out and for this to just be given to him because he got the endorsement. They made a big show of leaving an empty chair on the stage to kind of stand in for Michael Alfonso, who did not participate. He was in D.C. kind of hanging out with the congressional delegation. So what else did you kind of take away from that particular forum?
Look, locals are not happy with Michael Alfonso because he is. There's this heavy hand of Sean Duffy behind his campaign. Look at his finance report. All kinds of transportation industries giving money to Michael Alfonso. No offense, but a 26-year-old first-time candidate for Congress usually doesn't get money from like Southwest Airlines. That's not a big donor for first-time candidates, right? Okay, you see Sean Duffy's influence there. Donald Trump's endorsement. Sean Duffy is one of Donald Trump's favorites in the cabinet. I mean, they've been tight for a while. So all these things are happening to kind of push Duffy as the pick. And that's making people chafe a little bit. Like, I don't like this. And Jesse Eben kind of said, people don't like nepotism in the district. We're not happy about this. But again, if you've got a crowded field, how do you get through? And looking at the finance reports in general, nobody's raising a whole lot of money from individuals right now. Now, Kevin Hermaning, he put $1 million his own money in. But will he spend it? That's the big thing. And if he spends it, will there be more behind it? Because I've already seen $1.6 million, I believe, from Northwoods Future PAC, which was created to help Michael Alfonso, funded half by Sean Duffy's old campaign funds, half by Dick Yuan, this mega donor from Illinois, businessman. So even if you spend $1 million, is enough to catch up to Michael Alfonso. If you have three other options, or you're one of three options in the field, probably not. But does Eben drop out? Does Hermaning drop out? I mean, Nina's not really, no offense to Nina, but if you're a moderate choice in a very red district in the primary, not the best selling point. So, yeah, can they consolidate support behind somebody and the finance behind somebody really take on Michael Alfonso in a one-on-one battle?
And I should say we're sort of taking for granted that this is a Republican district because it's a very Republican district. There are Democrats in the field. But over in the 3rd congressional district, where it is a little bit more actually competitive, there was also a Democratic forum of the candidates there. So Rebecca Cook, again, has kind of had this like front runner status. She's run before. And there was also a little bit of tension there, again, with this idea of a coronation in the Democratic primary over in the 3rd.
It's the heavy hand of the DCCC. So they've already endorsed Cook, put her on their red blue program, which is targeting seats that want to flip to Democrat, Republican seats, flip Democratic. And look, Rebecca Cook is raising so much money. It is unbelievable. I don't know if I've ever seen a challenger candidate raise money like that in Wisconsin for a congressional seat. How many they have? But there is this vibe among activists in the district of like, we don't really like this a whole lot. You know, she rubs people the wrong way. And the question is kind of why. Let's be honest about politics. If you're an aggressive woman, sometimes ambitious, sometimes it gives you a bad reputation because people aren't now used to that sometimes. I'll put it politely that way. She, when Brad Paff beat her in the primary in 2022, she announced right away she's running to run 24. And that irritated some people because, oh, you should give Brad time. Why? If you want to run, run, right? But there was some chafing there. There's some chafing because she's this national attention grabber. There's also tension because she's portraying herself as this, you know, raised on a farm, I waitress all the time. She's a professional operative. She raised money for a career for a while. Now, she's doing a little bit right now. She's not a full-time operative, but that's her background. And so there's this chafing about, are you really who you say you are in Western Wisconsin?
So these are going to be some really interesting primaries to watch. And again, this dynamic with Michael Alfonso is really interesting. As I mentioned, he was in D.C. at the same time as that debate, and he has said that he is willing to debate, but he wants it to sort of be on his own terms in certain media markets, and so it'll be interesting to see if that takes place.
If you're getting knocked for not showing up to forums, you don't post a picture on social media being in D.C. in the quote-unquote swamp at a fundraiser at a lobbyist office. Grant, these with members of the Wisconsin delegation, okay, Tom Tiffany, others. I get that. That's kind of tone deaf. At the same time, let's be honest, what Alfonso is smart politics. If you are in the lead, if you have the money, and you have Trump's endorsement, why open yourself up to being ganged up upon in a primary or a debate? It makes sense. He wants to televise one before early voting starts ahead of the August 11th primary. If he acquits himself well there, maybe takes care of some things. But again, is it just like some local party officials who are really unhappy, or is it really the entire Republican base who's chafing at this? Even if there's a big segment of the population not happy with him, you got to give him the edge. He's probably the favorite to win the nomination and then become the next congressperson from the 7th district.
Yeah, we've talked about this several times, but, you know, again, there's that sort of old school way of doing politics, especially doing politics up north, and what he kind of represents, which is the turning points approach. So that's also, you know, posting photos of yourself doing something like really cool in D.C. Like, that is appealing to certain young voters. Mm-hmm. And so that'll also be an interesting dynamic to keep an eye on. Meanwhile, you tracked some numbers about all the spending on the ad wars in these races. And so I'm going to rattle off just a couple of numbers. So the House Majority PAC, which is a Democrat-aligned group, has made $8.5 million in initial reservations in the 3rd and 7th District, as well as in Milwaukee and Madison. And then the Congressional Leadership Fund, which is sort of a Republican equivalent group, $3.3 million in initial reservations in La Crosse, 3rd District, and Wausau, the 7th. What did these numbers tell you?
So, one, they're reservations. That's very key. They're not buys. Nobody's been put down yet. Republicans have pointed out, so the House Majority PAC put out this, I think they had a $240 or $270 reservation overall across 68 markets. You don't have much money in the bank right now. So this is maybe an aggressive budget. We'll see if they have the money to do it. I also remember in 2022, Brad Paff against Derek Van Orden, that House Majority PAC pulled back reservations. They'd actually pay for them in the end. By putting it down now, you're getting a better rate. It's like anything, supply and demand. Once more groups put ads down, the price goes up. If you reserve it now, you get a cheaper rate. Okay, makes sense. So let's look, though, at what they're doing. Actually, so we know they're going after the Democrats, the 1st and the 3rd, at least for now. That Wausau market actually touches the 3rd. Madison touches the 3rd and the 1st. So we don't know for sure. Like, they tell us, like, yeah, we're going after Brian Solomon in voter, but we can kind of tell. For the Republicans, they're basically defending Van Orden. there isn't really anybody we see right now on the Democratic side who's in the race who's raising money to get Brian Stahl a run for his money. So again, reservations, not buys, but it tells you where they're putting their focus, and you'll know come mid-October if this stuff is real. And secondly, if you're a Democrat, you want to beat Varick Van Orden, don't wait the last 2 weeks of the race to put an ad up on TV. Get out there like in September. That was a big mistake in 2022. House Majority PAC only had ads up the last 2 or 3 weeks of the race and started pulling them down. You can't wait that long. Early voting starts 2 weeks out. You need to define yourself earlier. So again, if it's really a real race, so it's really happening, by mid-September, you should see ads going up on the 3rd or into the 1st that shows you, like, okay, they're actually playing here.
And we often talk about how money is also sort of a messaging tactic. So even just the act of this national group saying we're going to put $8 million into these two races in Wisconsin, it's a little bit of a signal of, like, you should take us seriously. Yeah. We are really in the fight.
Absolutely, because Donald Trump's numbers aren't very good right now. So if they stay where they are, there are opportunities there, like in the 1st Congressional District.
And speaking of the 1st Congressional District, there is potentially a new contender jumping in. So we've talked a little bit in the past about how Brian Stahl, the incumbent, he is a fundraising machine. He's sort of comfortably there. It does not seem like the Democratic field is really kind of giving him a run for his money. And then we are starting to hear that potentially there might be an additional candidate jumping in, this Milwaukee alderman.
Yeah, so I kind of hinted about him last week, a little tease that he was making calls. So Peter LeGuise, sorry if I said his name correctly. But there are a couple of problems for him. One, he's not in the district. Now, legal is not a problem at all. You don't live in your district to run for it. You have to live there after swearing or something like that. But either way, residency is not a problem to run for it. But that district swings from the southern Milwaukee suburbs down to Kenosha, over west into like Walworth County, Racine, and Beloit and Janesville. If you're from Milwaukee, how are you going to appeal to voters in Walworth County? Because they're going, well, you're a city guy. So that could be a problem. Number two, there was a story a couple of years ago that he was abusive towards staff, female staff in the government office. Okay, it's not like things we're seeing in D.C. right now where people are misbehaving, we put it nicely. But still, that could be an issue for you. And can he raise the money? And now, as a gay candidate, there is a national network of gay donors who are looking to help candidates. Tammy Baldwin has a phenomenal fundraising network, in part because of that. So can Peter create the same thing? Can he create some excitement? Will the DCCC get involved? All big questions. And is this really a down payment on 2028? So 2026, yes, it looks like a bad environment right now. And I stress right now. Trump, 3 polls out this week had Trump in the low 30s nationally for job approval rating. You know, gas is almost $4 a gallon coming into the office today. If it's down to $2 by mid-October and Trump's in the mid-40s or upper 40s, different environment. But if it's still where we're at right now, maybe there's a shot there. Maybe.
And, you know, another sort of interesting thing is that he has a little bit more of a traditional politics background in that he currently holds elected office, which is not true for the rest of the Democratic field. Mm-hmm. So this will be a really interesting race to watch. This week, too, we saw oral arguments in this kind of long-lasting Supreme Court case, Wisconsin Voter Alliance v. Secord, I think is how we say this. The problem with being writers is that we don't always know how things are pronounced. But this is the case of this sort of conservative activist group that has been trying to get voter data about people who lost their rights to vote because they are under guardianship. The sort of conspiracy theory is that those people are voting anyways. And so the argument is about what constitutes a public document and what is sort of a private court or medical record. And so these arguments were really interesting, and we have a little bit of video of what that looks like.
If we step back and just look at, okay, what was the goal of the state legislature in 54.75 and 54.25, we'll see that the privacy concerns and the public data, that is the person who lost their ineligibility to vote, can both be handled through these different processes. The whole point is to ensure that the laws are followed, but also to ensure that the privacy of these guardianship records are maintained while the public record, that is, who has the right to vote, is known.
The intent was to get the names and addresses of individuals who've been declared ineligible to vote due to incompetency, and they wanted to cross-reference that on the WisVote database to determine if these individuals have been voting. That's why they need the names and the addresses. Those things can't be redacted or it frustrates the entire purpose. There's a website maintained by CCAP where all of the court's forms are listed in blank form so that the public can see this is what a blank form looks like. That GN 3180 isn't even there. The public can't even access the blank form. There's nothing public about this at all. The document itself in big bold print says for official use only.
So this case had been, it had already gone before the court. They didn't sort of decide on the merits. They just said initially that the data couldn't be released. But now they are weighing sort of what the data actually means. Something that kind of stood out to me, I read all of the amicus briefs. Ooh. And one of them that was filed by the Freedom of Information Council was about sort of needing this to be settled. They weren't weighing in on whether it should be settled in one direction or another, but they were talking about sort of the burden of proof of these public documents. So it's really interesting, like, even though it is this kind of conservative activist and it's tied to 2020 election conspiracy theories, seeing these different players weigh in. What else stood out to you?
So the Wisconsin Voter Alliance sought these records in 14 different counties. And why it got the Supreme Court once was the 4th District Court of Appeals, so it was denied by one county, appealed to the 4th District. The 4th said you can't have these records. The 2nd District, in an opinion penned by Marie Lazar, said actually you can, and the decision came out after the 4th. The Supreme Court slapped down that decision saying, no, that's how it works. In our system, if an appeals court issues a ruling, that is binding on everybody else. The 2nd, with that decision Lazar written, tried to differentiate the case a little bit. I'm not a lawyer, a little bit of a stretch in some ways, but still, that's why it went up. It also came up during the debate in the Supreme Court where Chris Hare kept saying, you've been overturned, you won't follow precedent. You know, this is a horrible thing. So then Lazar said, well, that's because I'm independent. Anyway, what I'm watching here is, you know, Eric Cardall was arguing to the justices, you could actually order redactions of these documents to make it okay to get them. And a couple were like, what? Like, you want us to decide how to make this work? That's not our role. Now, you might argue the Supreme Court has taken an expansive role, view of its role in other things before, but a little bit kind of like, I don't think so. And you heard Rebecca Bradley saying, well, the Justice Commission is not doing its job, so you have to allow these watchdogs to do it. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But if I had to bet my mortgage payment, I'm going to guess the WVA is going to lose this case.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, again, this sort of idea of in a democracy and one where there is this burden of having as much access as possible to government records, kind of how do they decide this in a way that, I mean, statute is quite clear about guardianship records in particular, but how do they decide this in a way that kind of also respects the role of the watchdog, which, you know, all sides kind of benefit from at different times. That brings us to the stock report. Rising is elderly inmates.
Yeah, so an interesting report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum this week. The share of inmates who are over 60 in our prison population has been going up. I think we had 330 in 2000. We were at 1,900 in 2023, so quite an expansion. And first of all, it's truth in sentencing. It's back in the 1990s, they passed laws in Wisconsin that if you're sentenced 10 years, you're serving 10 years. No more of this, get sentenced to 10, serve 2, and you're out. That's not it. There's actually more people who are older getting in trouble, which I thought was kind of interesting. I guess we're a rascally generation, my age group. But there also is a cost to this. So like one prison, for example, in Wisconsin now has an infirmary ward to take care of elderly inmates. And one thing to watch is the governor has announced this new process for commutations, which are actually people out of prison, not just absolving the record of what they did before. Will age play a role in how he decides his case? That's something to watch going forward.
Interesting. Brian Schimming, there was a little bit of a question about his future over the weekend, and it's a little bit still of an open question.
So I know Brian Schimming is still the state party chair. What I don't know for sure is what happened during a meeting over the weekend on the executive committee, in part because the committee now requires members to sign a non-exposure agreement, which I've never heard of for, by the way, party committee. But look, we've all seen the stories kind of post April 7th election of Republicans saying, this is not working. Brian Schimming has got to go. He's not raising money. We're not winning races unless Trump's on the ballot. What is going on here? So going into the weekend, there's a guy named Brett Gazalewski, who was a member of Turning Point, Austin Executive Committee, was basically saying, I'm going back to Wisconsin this meeting because there needs to be accountability. And then Saturday afternoon, he was tweeting, like, people being held accountable, chairs, might start clipping resources from conservatives like Michael Alfonso and Tom Tiffany. Kind of an interesting quote. So then I started making calls on Monday, like, okay, what's going on? Didn't realize that this NDA was in place. It happened in December, but I was getting calls back from a lot of my sources around the party and realized that, oh, this is why. They signed NDAs now. So I had two members say, I can't talk about it because of that, and one told me, hey, Brian's still the chair. So my questions are, for how much longer and what would it take to get rid of him? I'm not advocating for Brian to go away, obviously, but if you look at the finance reports this week, we get monthly federal ones. The state Democratic Party outraised this Republican one by 3-1, that's why it's a federal report. The state GOP has not outraised the Democratic Party on their federal reports since February of 2021 or March of 2021. I did go through every report the last 5 years. I put that in a spreadsheet. That tells you this issue predates Schimming. It's not all his fault, but it's why they brought him in. They gave him a salary, the first paid chair in anybody's memory, to solve this problem. It's not going well so far. Now, part of the problem is, what do you sell? Like the Democrats, they sell we are a turnout operation. We are helping people get elected. We're people at doors. Republican Party of Wisconsin doesn't really have that kind of operation right now. The other big thing is being a conduit from donors to candidates. Remember, state law says you have an unlimited contribution to a party, make an unlimited transfer to a candidate. We don't have a nominee yet for governor. Yes, we think it's going to be Tom Tiffany and the Republicans. Okay, miracles do happen, and maybe he won't. But if he's it, he's not officially it, and he's not endorsed until the May convention. After that, you can pitch, hey, we're here to help Tom Tiffany run for governor. You should give us money. What do you pitch for right now? The other thing going on is, as many members of the committee are unhappy with Brian as there are, who do you replace him with? Who would you find to take this job, which is not a great job sometimes? It is hard to raise money in Wisconsin if you're a party chair without the governor's office. This whole law about unlimited contributions, Scott Walker and Robin Voss basically hatched it more than a decade ago, thinking we've got all the keys to the castle right now. This would be great for us. But once you lose governor's office, it's become hard to raise money. So that's going on. Another thing you just remember is the White House. Is the White House going to stay with Schimming? Like, if the White House wants him gone, that probably would factor into it. But convention is next month. It's probably going to be a mess. We were there last year, and there are people passing out flyers calling for him to be taken down. You can't remove a chair from the floor of the convention. It's not in the party constitution. Yes, I've read Wisconsin GOP constitution. I know it's a dorky thing to do. But there's not an avenue there. The executive committee is the big thing. Like, are they going to at some point ever get an alternative, enough votes to depose him? Don't forget, his term runs through December, so maybe that's what ends it in the end. But for now, Schimming is still chair, but his grip remains tenuous on that position.
I mean, yeah, I think it is worth noting that some of that really public infighting emerged after the Crawford election, right, which again, when they had that sort of postmortem to look at why can't we win these spring elections, and then as you mentioned, the state convention, that I think within 40 minutes or something, a fight broke out on the floor between these kind of different factions of the state GOP, and he kind of, I think, finds himself a little bit in the crossfire of that. So this has been kind of an ongoing challenge for Brian Schimming. It'll be really interesting to see how that plays out. Following this week is Sarah Rodriguez.
So before we start this one, I'm going to tell you, I've covered the budget for 26 years. Do you want to know how many budget negotiations I have covered that were in public?
Was it zero?
None. Not a single one. That said, if you go to a group of Democratic Party members and say, I'm going to develop a budget behind a curtain with Democratic leaders, it's not a great thing to say for two reasons. Excuse me. One, okay, look, yes, Governor Evers and his predecessor would have like public discussions. They go out and, you know, take public input. Absolutely. Joint Finance Committee, it goes out and does these, call it the road show, three or four public hearings, takes testimony. But they do everything behind closed doors. I have not seen the governor, any governor, call in the media to watch. I'm going to negotiate with DHS right now. Come watch how we do this. Or, hey, I'm talking to stakeholder X. Come see how things happen, okay? But you don't give people an opportunity to pile on you. And that's what Sarah's done. It's the latest in a series of gaffes. So remember, last week, I think it was, there was an audio leaked of her saying she doubts if Hong or Matt Barnes could beat Tom Tiffany. She off the wrong foot back in July because Evers announced that he was not seeing re-election. Her video went up right away afterward, and she announced the next day, I think it was. People were like, well, how come your video was actually posted a week earlier? And she's like, oh, well, I had advanced knowledge, which wasn't really true. Like, she found out the morning of his announcement he wasn't going to run, but she basically got prepped because why wouldn't you? He hadn't raised any money the first half of the year. But you add all these things up, and there's a question, is there a pattern developing? It does suggest a little bit of inexperience. She was a one-term member of the assembly. They withdrew her seat to be more Republican. She ran for lieutenant governor, won a pretty easy primary. She hasn't really been tested very hard. So you just see these things going on. You're going, okay, is this an experience? Is she trusting people too much? Like, if you're in public office, you assume you're always being taped. Always. Yes, she's talking to a bunch of Democratic activists, but guess what? Some of them don't support her. They support her opponents. They're going to tape you and be, oh, this is not good for you, and go share it around. What I'm watching for, though, is all these gaffes aside, will she get outside help? She's talked about this for months, that she has $2 million from the Democratic Governors Association coming her way. She said in January, $2.5 million from outside groups who have pledged to support her, or like donors pledging to support her, giving $2.5 million to groups, something like that. Where's the money? right? Now, if that much money is there, that's like 10 weeks of TV. So we should see it in mid-May, right? Early June. And for any of these candidates, I don't care if you are Francesca Hong or Missy Hughes or Joel Brenner, David Crowley, where's the outside help going to come from? Usually it's from like nice sounding groups like A Brighter Wisconsin or We Love Wisconsin or like Education for Wisconsin, whatever. Then they do the dirty work. They raise your profile, they attack your opponent. Mandela Barnes has the highest name ID in this primary field. All right? Not all good name ID, but highest name ID. So if these groups are going to spend to get you even with Mandela, what happens if Mandela has a group that spends to get him going far? Can you catch up? So Rodriguez, yes, this is not great Simon experience, but my bigger question is, when does the money come? We're not just heard about for any of them. Kel DeRoy's got endorsed by WEAC last week. Great. Where's the money? How does it really enhance your chance to win? They all need help. Nobody's raised enough money to be on the air consistently for 2 months for the primary. So, yeah.
And
when the money flows.
A situation where if there's seven candidates and the vast majority of the electorate barely knows that an election is going on, much less who they prefer, then these little things, a bump here or a loss there, can make sort of all the difference in the world. Before we wrap up, we wanted to acknowledge that this week we lost Dan Bice in the state of Wisconsin. He's a legend of Wisconsin political journalism. I am obviously newer to the world of Wisconsin politics, but I would see him at every single event, sort of working sources, and just really representative of this kind of, I think, old school form of journalism. Anything you want to share?
It's a loss. He's going to lose a voice in the press corps because there aren't enough of us anymore covering these things to keep an eye on what's going on.
Yeah, so really sad, and our condolences to his family. That'll do it for us on Rewind This Week. I am Anjuban Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
See you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.